The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
One of the things that I see as I look around the room at all of you, that looks to me like none of you are monastics. I don't see any monastic robes, shaved heads. Looks to me like most of you are pretty much what we call lay people. And I think that's great. And there are some people who think that if you're going to get serious about Buddhism, you should become a monastic. And then some spouses or partners sometimes worry about people who are meditating too much, that are they going to go off and become a monk or a nun and, you know, and abandon the world? Some people do that, and hopefully that's the right thing for them to do. But what I want to say is that if any of you have ever thought about, you know, maybe I should go off and become a monastic, or that's where the real practice is, stop that. The real practice is where you are. The real practice is the life that you have. And in fact, it might be the best place for you to practice. To run away from it and to go someplace else sometimes is we miss a huge opportunity. I've lived in monasteries. I benefited from being a monk, so it's also a nice life. But a good monastery, maybe from the outside, looks like it's an angelic place. Everyone must be floating on clouds, must be enlightened, and everyone is always kind and loving, and there's lots of time, and everybody stays calm and just kind of floats, and things get done, but, you know, everyone's just kind of like, you know, somehow things get done, but everyone's just kind of floating and just doing things slowly, mindfully, and they're studying and listening to great Dharma talks, and, you know, it's just a wonderful life, must be. When you're in a monastery, sometimes it feels a little bit more like an insane asylum. The people who come there are like a hospital. The people who come there really need to be there because the world out there was just too hard for them, and they have all these challenges. And I've had one of the great abbots, Western abbots of the Western monks, tell me, you know, most of the people who come here just can't really cope with the world and with each other, and they're just trying to run away and just kind of be in this kind of, you know, little bubble of something, and it's really hard to live together and find our way. And then, you know, you have to get up. I used to get up at 3:30 in the morning. Yeah, we had lots of time. You know, just all day long, starting at the day, you know, starts at 3:30, so that's a lot of time. And then there's a schedule to follow. You know, you need to ring a bell, you have to go somewhere. Wait a minute, I'm not ready. I once did a monastery in Japan, tried to brush my teeth after breakfast. I got reprimanded. That's not the schedule. You have to go, you know. That was a place we had to run from one thing to another, like the bell rang, I could run to get the next thing, and, you know, brush your teeth, run. This is some corporate jobs are more relaxed than it. And then there's these difficult habits. Some habits are wonderful and kind, and some habits are stern and strict. And I practiced with one who was kind of like he was more like a sergeant, you know, that he was a Mother Teresa or something. He was, you know, like, he was tough and stern, and, you know, you just have to, you know, push ahead. And it was no quarter given for our practice, for ourselves. And then there are abbots who have all these needs for help and work and take care of things. And you end up being a monk. You're not meditating all the time. You're just like cleaning the monastery and tending to people, tending to the abbot, doing all this stuff. One of the greatest abbots for many of us in the 20th century was a man named Ajahn Chah. There's wonderful books about his teachings. But in the end of his life, he had dementia, serious dementia. And so some of the primary caretakers for him were the Western monks. And they'd gone to Asia to become enlightened. They ended up in Asia caring for him and staying up all night and changing his diapers and cleaning him and feeding him. And that's what they did. So monastic life, turns out, is much more like daily life outside the monastery than people assume. Meaning that the challenge that you have in your life, that's your monastery. That's your place of practice. You don't have to go elsewhere to practice. Don't go to the monasteries to escape this. Just whatever your challenges are, make that your monastery. Because if you go to the monastery, it'll just find you there. Sooner or later, you have to deal with these things. Sooner or later, you have to be challenged by all this. And I tell you this because of my own life story with monasteries, was that it was kind of a good fit for me to be in a monastery in some ways. I liked the lifestyle a lot. It was easy, relatively easy for me. What was hard was the life after the monastery, being not in the monastery. And that's where I was challenged. In all kinds of ways, I was never challenged in the monastery. And it was really good for me. It was really necessary for me to face myself and see myself in that the world. And I think I'm a better person because of it. The monastery helped. It was an important part of it all. But so don't set up Buddhism as being out there, or if only I could do this. And certainly meditate. Certainly it's nice to go on retreats. But maybe it's your daily life as it's given to you with all the challenges that can be your practice. That is, if you want to go to the monastery, you have one already. Your boss at work is your abbot. You know, and some abbots are not so easy. And some of the if you go to a monastery, some of your fellow monks are difficult. I sat in the monastery in Japan with a monk who hated me, but he sat next to me. And he would be kind of bullying me while we sat and meditated. Poke me. And all kinds of things. And at one point I was on the verge of punching him out in the monastery during meditation. Can you believe it? So I had to contend with that. So you might have some difficult co-workers or family members. And you think to yourself, if only I can go to the monastery, everyone's going to be so nice. No, it's just the difficult monk, the difficult nun that you're with. So what I'm saying is approach your life as you have it, as a place where you're going to understand yourself, see yourself, meet yourself in some deep way. The challenges are not of your life, are not the Dharma challenges. They're Dharma opportunities. They might be worldly challenges. They might be personal challenges because of all the stuff what you bring to it. But they're not. They don't have to stay challenges that way. They're Dharma opportunities. How do you find your freedom? How do you find your compassion? How do you find deeper understanding? How do you see this? Okay, here is where practice is. Finally, I have an opportunity to practice. I thought I was supposed to be meditating. But now I have to deal with the police officer who pulled me over for speeding. Okay, this is practice. Now how do I practice with this? How do I live with this as opposed to, I wasn't speeding and this is not fair, and maybe I was, but I'll tell him I wasn't. And who knows what you do, right? But it's all, this is opportunity to practice. And then how do you practice this way with everything in your life? You practice, one of the ways you practice is figure out a way that you allow your emotional life to be fluid inside of you. Not bottled up, not stuck, but also not so pressurized that it becomes a volcano. Find a way that your emotional life can be dynamic and fluid and changing so that it moves through you. There's movement in your emotional life. For some people, that's one of the things meditation does, is you sit down to be with yourself, and as your breathing relaxes, as your breathing becomes more easeful and flowing, it's easier to let the emotional life kind of also flow. But if the breathing gets tight or contracted or shallow, sometimes that's because we're holding on to something, we're closing down around something. And so just watching the breathing and helping the breathing be relaxed and open helps the emotional life be more fluid and relaxed and moving through us. If we are afraid, sometimes we freeze around things. If we're angry, we tend to be stuck sometimes. If we're having desires, that also there's a stuckness. We want to learn how to recognize when we're stuck. Recognize when we've kind of gotten kind of tight, when we've kind of glommed on to something like a concern. Our world has gotten narrower, caught up in a small way. Some people get stuck around their attitude towards themselves. I'm a terrible person, or I'm the best, but other people don't realize it. You know, and suddenly the self becomes a small little universe we're stuck in. So part of, I think, what we want to do is to have everything fluid, let it keep moving and moving. And if meditation doesn't do that enough, some people find that walking meditation can do that. Especially if maybe the walking meditation is not too slow. Because slow walking meditation sometimes can glom on, you know, can support kind of the weight of our life kind of carries, can pull in, and we don't see that we're still living under the weight of things or the stuckness of things. Sometimes faster walking can be a way of kind of loosening things up, keeping things fluid and moving, and not getting stuck in what we're thinking about, not be stuck in what we're feeling, and just kind of let it move. And the idea is to look for the movement, look for the unstuckness. Don't look for making things go away. And as you do that, maybe you start seeing yourself better. You see how you get hold on, how you cling, what you cling to, what you're afraid of, and how you react to fear or fall into fear or give into it. You start seeing yourself more and more ways. And you might see in the fluidity and dynamic how there's space to be more generous and kind and supportive for yourself and for the people around you. So to look for fluidity, to look for movement rather than stuckness, to recognize when you're stuck. And the stuckness is easy. I've been stuck. At red traffic lights because my future was being thwarted by a red light. And, you know, shoot, I should have driven a little bit faster. I wasn't driving fast enough. You know, why do they have these lights so long in Redwood City? I should write a letter to the mayor. You know, and this is terrible. And, you know, I just kind of put my foot on the gas pedal and see, you know, like the first little instant micro moment that it turns green, I'm ready to go. Probably have an accident like that. So that's not how I drive, but I'm just kind of like right there, that's the example of being stuck. Learn to recognize that. And as you learn to recognize yourself and use all these things as your practice, you will probably begin discovering layers and layers of depth inside of you. Layers and layers of how you're much more than you ever could have imagined as you start seeing more deeply what can operate in you. I'm convinced that all of you have a wonderful heart deep inside. And so to have this process of really meeting yourself and seeing everything as practice, and learning how to keep it fluid, not stuck, with time you'll go through the layers and you'll find your beautiful heart. So, and if you still want to go to a monastery, well, you can come talk to me. Thank you.